How do you make that promise agnostic to political parties, the promise of becoming net zero by any day? The problem is the efficient thing is the unfair thing. If you think about the carbon that's already out there in the atmosphere, a lot of that carbon has been put out by the developed countries, and they still continue to put out more carbon. For example, the United States produces 16 tons of carbon per person per year. Tanzania produces 0.2 tons of carbon per person per year. I think what it makes sense is for payments to take place from the high emitters to the low emitters. The beauty of this is Tanzania now has an incentive not to consume more carbon, because if it increases its consumption of carbon, it reduces the amount it gets from the fund.
Welcome to Mindful Businesses, presented by Sarani, and I'm your host, Vedaya Iyer. In our podcast, we bring to you brands that are mindful in their practices and processes. A mindful business adopts and employs sustainable social, economic, and environmental practices. Today, we have on our show Dr. Raghuram Rajan, Catherine Dussac Miller, Distinguished Service Professor of Finance at Chicago Booth School. He was the 23rd governor of the Reserve Bank of India, and he also served as a chief economist at the IMF. Dr. Rajan joins us from Chicago, Illinois. Welcome, Raghu.
Thanks for having me.
In an op-ed published in 1970 in the New York Times by Dr. Milton Friedman, who went on to win the Nobel Prize in Economics, he wrote, and I quote, "Businesses that take seriously its responsibilities for providing employment, eliminating discrimination, avoiding pollution, and whatever else may be the catchword of the contemporary crop of reformers," he compared it to unadulterated socialism. He went on to say, and I paraphrase now, that the goal of the business should be to make as much money as possible while conforming to the social norms. And that is about 50 years ago. Now we've come a full about turn. We've done a complete about turn. What has changed?
To some extent, what has changed is that businesses have come under a lot more social pressure than at that time. It is certainly true that Milton Friedman said the business of business is making money. I think the second part of what he said is very important, that he said within the constraints of the laws and the norms of society. By norms, he basically meant reasonable business practice. Now, what he was very worried about, which is something we should worry about today also, it is important that we remember the basic business of business is making goods and services that you customers want to buy at a reasonable price. That's what a business is about. Now, everything else is over and above it. Obviously, you have to respect the laws. Obviously, you have to do it in the most environmentally reasonable way possible. Now, what he was trying to say, which I think is being debated today, is that you don't have to do anything more than what the laws say. And I think today, because of the difficulty that we have in passing the laws that matter, because of the differences in opinion within society, there's a lot of public pressure being applied on corporations, for example, to be better at emissions than what the law requires. And this is where Milton Friedman would disagree. He would say democracy means you pass the laws. If you can't pass the laws, then trying to enforce them on a company without them being passed by the democratic majority is not, you know, consistent with a democracy. It is some private interest group which says that this is more important and I will try and enforce it by picketing the corporation, etc. You could argue about that for a long time. But basically, I think his point was certainly if you make a good product, you will make money. Unfortunately, he wasn't particularly political. And by saying the business was to make money, the vision that comes in people's minds is of people rampaging, of companies rampaging through society, selling shoddy products in order to make the most profit possible. He would say that's a very short-term profit and you can't sustain that. You would have to be much more thoughtful about selling a good product.
It gives you a vision of avarice.
Exactly.
So we are moving from avarice to empathy.
Not necessarily. I think that's what corporations would like us to believe. And there are a few corporations that genuinely care more broadly. But for a lot of corporations, it is, how do I maximize the bottom line, but address these other constraints that are imposed on me. I have to look as if I care about the environment. Let me give you an example. So we did this study on corporate objectives. Whole bunch of corporate objectives say we care about the environment. One of the interesting things is, when do corporations assume that objective of caring about the environment? Disproportionately when they're fined by the EPA for violations. In other words, when you are caught out, in order to signal that you've actually seen the light and you're going to turn over a new leaf, you espouse that as a corporate objective. So I don't want your listeners to be overly cynical about this, but I would say when a corporation expresses a whole degree of sensitivity for the public good, I mean, a fair amount of it, which is what Milton Friedman said, is hogwash. Now, what I would think is important is not to rely on the corporation to do good on its own, but to make it easier for it to do good by passing the appropriate laws that you think it ought to obey. In other words, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. I mean, keep separate the objective of making money off the commercial proposition, which is what the corporation is about, from the social good, which is what the government is about. But try and ensure the corporation comes under significant sort of rules and regulations, of course, in a reasonable quantity that makes it do the right thing.
So I understand your point about democracy, and if you live in a democratic world or a country, the laws will be passed. But you are a researcher at Chicago Booth, which is primarily free market, as libertarian as possible. And you are saying that laws must be enacted to make corporations perform?
No, absolutely. So first, a university is a big tent. I don't go to my office every day and genuflect at the altar of Milton Friedman, any academic god, is a contradiction in terms. Your whole objective is to challenge the wisdom. All I'm saying is, in the current environment where corporations have 15 different objectives and claim to be adhering to all of them, where the business roundtable says we care about all our stakeholders, we're going to do everything good for all of them, well, you're sort of in a situation where they say they do all this, but obviously, corporations have to choose. They have to choose occasionally between, you know, their shareholder and their worker. They have to choose between the environment and providing jobs. I mean, there are lots of choices they have to make. And being vacuous about it and saying we care about everybody is not helpful in letting you understand what they really care about. And I think it sort of can hide a lot of hypocrisy. I think what is important really is, you know, for corporations to have a set of clear guidelines which they have to follow. I mean, I'm not saying that they're all untrustworthy. I'm not saying there aren't great CEOs who are great human beings also. What I am saying is, don't rely on that. Don't rely on self-regulation by corporations. And I don't also want us to overregulate the corporation. But if you want them to do something, for example, reduce emissions, make that a law. Let them follow the law. And that is the way, I mean, whenever we rely on the good intentions of corporations, I mean, remember a time when all these social platforms were really idealistic and we thought do no evil, which was, I think, Google's motto, reflected the true instincts. And now today, of course, many of these social platforms are, public sees them with a much, much darker view than it used to see them. And in part, it is because we relied on them to regulate themselves. And we said, you're going to figure out what content to allow, what sort of, and see what happened. And the net effect is, now we've got so much disagreement about, you know, say a platform like Twitter, which is in the news today. Should Twitter allow free debate or should it censor debate more? And you've got all sorts of sides being formed on this. And I think this is where sensibly society will sit down and say, here are some rules which you have to follow. And hopefully it's a light set of rules, it's a clear set of rules, but leaving it totally unregulated is, I think, leaving it to the good intentions of corporations, which I think is very weak.
But the truth of the matter is, even if you have regulations, only if it increases profit or some other benefit for the company, till then they are not going to do it, right?
Absolutely. But that, again, I want to distinguish between long-term value maximization and short-term ripping people off. If I rip you off in the short term, yes, I can make more money off you, but then you never come back to deal with me again. I think it's a mistaken to believe every corporation is short-term and wants to rip you off. You know, typically the best managed corporations think about the long-term, think about how they can make money by producing the best product for their customers or the most sort of best product for the money that the customers pay. And so in that sense, I don't think that the natural instinct is to rip you off, but I do think that where the law doesn't force them to do something, they have a choice. Do I become a good global citizen and cut my emissions even though no law requires me to do that? Even though it costs me money, even though it probably means I cannot spend that money on investment, I cannot create jobs, I cannot do all these nice things because I care about the environment. So do you want that kind of calculation to be done by the corporations? Or do you want the corporation to say, I have to obey the law, the emission standard is thus and such, I can't violate it, and maybe I go a little below that just to stay on the right side of the law in case, you know, the law changes. So in these two situations, I think it's better that we have the latter, where you don't leave it to the good intentions of the corporation, but the corporation sort of has to stay within the law. Now, that is not to say there aren't places where corporations have to make judgments, but you don't want everything to be a judgment call. You want as little as possible to be a judgment call in the sense of where society really cares about something. Well, make it a law.
So when we talk about a sustainable world and its impact, we talk about people, the profit and the planet, right? The triple bottom line. So for instance, if we have, I'm just thinking of some law, the minimum wage law. So if we increase minimum wage, there are people who will say that it will cause inflation. You know, so what do you tell them? The businesses will have to pay more. And we already have, what, 8.5% inflation right now in the United States?
Every decision has some winners and losers typically, right? And you have to make choices. And if you increase the minimum wage, you're saying as a society, there are some people who have relatively weak bargaining power. And I want to protect them by setting a minimum. At the same time, you must recognize that this has some costs, that you're increasing the cost of labor to some corporations. It's not cost-free. And that those corporations will either pass it on in higher prices, that is your inflation you're talking about, or some of them might find that, oh, this has become too expensive for me to run this particular franchise or to run this particular restaurant, and I'll close it down because it's just too expensive. Now, everybody wants to point to studies, and there are studies which find that, you know, increase the minimum wage, there's no short-term effect. In fact, it may increase business, and that's possible. But it doesn't happen in every circumstance. You know, the notion that choices don't have consequences and we can have everything and be happy, I think, is a recipe for La La Land. This is where, for example, when the corporations in their business roundtable statement in 2019 said, we care about everybody, we're going to do good to everybody. That's a nonsense statement. It's a completely vacuous statement. You can never do good to everybody if you're running a serious business. You have to make choices. Sometimes it is for the shareholder versus the employee. Sometimes for the employee versus the shareholder. Think about Google. You know, there was a project at the Defense Department, which basically was about artificial intelligence for drones in devising targets for military users, right? And a bunch of Google employees said, no, we think this is terrible. We're not going to work on this. And Google at that time just dropped the project. It said, okay, our employees are more important than the bottom line because they contribute to a larger bottom line in all the other stuff we're doing. So they dropped the Department of Defense project. And so that's an example where a corporation has to make a tough choice. It can't be nice to both the Department of Defense, which is an important customer, its employees, an important stakeholder, as well as shareholders. It's making choices. It's probably saying, in the interest of maintaining the sustainability of the company, I have to emphasize my employees, and that is going to be good for the long run bottom line. But the Department of Defense gets hurt in the short run.
So you served as the governor of the Reserve Bank of India. And as a banker, I have to ask you a few questions.
Well, I'm more of a bank regulator than a banker, though I did work in a bank once upon a time. But yes, happy to answer the question.
So there are these neobanks, and they seem to be disrupting the banking system. They are working, I want to say under the regulators' radar, because one of our guests, Ernan, the founder's name was Ram Palaniappan. What he said is that the regulations for now work for the banks, not for the customers. As the neobanks come, how will the banking environment change to help more people get fair credit, grow their credit fairly, not be predated by the banks? How will it work?
It's a great question. I mean, when you say neobanks, I presume you mean the kind of entities that use fintech, that use a lot of data, that use automated structures and so on.
Exactly, yeah.
I think they're very valuable competition to the banks because they are using data that banks never used, never collected, maybe don't even know some banks how to collect that data. As a result, are able to make better credit decisions. If I know that you pay your utility bills on time every month, I have a greater sense of confidence in you. If I know your friends are all people who pay their bills, I have a greater sense of confidence in you. These entities use a lot of data that typically the state-owned banks didn't use, and that has expanded the possibility of credit. Now, one has to be a little careful. In some situations, what would be ideal is combining the savvy of the banks. They know lending, had been through downturns, they know what happens then, with the optimism and the technical skills of the fintech companies. Sometimes fintech companies do things which no banker would, but no banker would for good reason. And then the fintech company finds it's made massive losses because it's subjected itself to, you know, basically ripoffs. So they do bring a new facet. It is not to say that the old problems don't emerge with some of them also. I mean, as you know, the Chinese government has been going after Ant Financial, the fintech arm of Alibaba. And part of what the Chinese government is saying is you're following monopolistic practices. You are not so much predating on your customer, but you are monopolizing the data. You're not giving it to the state-owned banks. And as a result, you're squeezing the customer with excessive rates and so on, higher rates than would be possible if you, you know, allowed for free and fair competition. And Financial is basically saying, it's the data we collected. Those guys didn't collect the data. Now you're telling us to give the data to everyone. But you see the challenge that you can be really good as a fintech company, but the incentive to make money, which we talked about earlier in the program, doesn't go away. And therefore, regulators have to be aware that even though this opens up possibility of bringing in a whole lot of people who were excluded earlier, you have to be careful because these people who are excluded are also vulnerable to predation, to, you know, monopolistic practices and so on. So just the fact that they've got access doesn't necessarily mean that they'll never be ripped off. Now, you might say getting access and being ripped off a little is better than having no access at all. And that may well be true, but there may be a better solution than just letting them run riot either.
So from banking, let's move on to the environment. That is in everybody's mind because of COP26, the goals people are setting up for becoming net zero, 2050, 2060. I know you're a macroeconomist, right? But how do people at the micro level do things to impact that change?
I think we all have a role to play. To say somebody else is going to do it for us minimizes the involvement of people in society. And so I think we should all be cognizant that we have to play that role. As you well know, growing up in India, we were often sort of trained to economize. We used to use paper bags made out of newspapers. We used to try and use both sides of a copybook, use the cover, use the backside, use every side. And, you know, clothes were handed down within the family from, I remember wearing my uncle's trousers. Because they were 30 years later, they were back in style. They were, they were narrow legs. But these are the kinds of things that, you know, you did. And I think we need to embrace that old philosophy of being careful on consumption. As I think former finance minister in India, Yashwant Sinha, used to say, if the whole world consumed at the rate of a suburban American household, there would be no planet left. Just imagine the Indian household consuming at this rate. I mean, you simply do not have sustainability. If we are to create space for the poorer countries in the world to be able to consume more, richer countries have to tighten their belt somewhat. So that's the personal effort. You cannot sort of preach conservation, etc., while having a year-round heated swimming pool. You have to ask what the cost of that is. I mean, no matter whether you buy carbon credits for that or not, you have to think about your own lifestyle. That said, I think there is an important role for getting the incentives right globally. This is where, I mean, most economists would say, let's impose a common carbon tax around the world so that everybody sees the common cost of producing carbon, and that would be the efficient thing to do. The problem is the efficient thing is the unfair thing. If you think about the carbon that's already out there in the atmosphere, a lot of that carbon has been put out by the developed countries, and they still continue to put out more carbon. For example, the United States produces 16 tons of carbon per person per year. Tanzania produces 0.2 tons of carbon per person per year today. And this is after all the conservation, etc., that has happened in advanced countries. Should Tanzania have the same responsibility for reducing its carbon as the United States should have?
That leads to my next question about just transition. Not sure if you've heard that terminology. And why should Tanzania now say, who's trying to grow, who's trying to develop, who's trying to catch up with the United States in terms of their infrastructure, their building, their development, why should they say, okay, I'm going to stop at 0.2 tons, whereas United States and Russia and many of the other countries, if we take what we call stock carbon, carbon that they have not going forward in the past, how much they have put out in the atmosphere, how is it fair to Tanzania?
It's certainly